This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The last 2 weeks of July are, statistically, the hottest stretch of the year. As part of the nationally coordinated summer heat action, Bill McKibben, author and co-founder of 350.org, will speak this Wednesday, July 17th, in Vancouver, Washington, to talk about climate change and the movement to turn it around. KBOO will broadcast his talk live.
Either Exxon has to give in or physics has to give in. It'll be hard to change Exxon's mind. I think it'll be harder to get physics to compromise.
That's Bill McKibben of 350.org. Tune in Wednesday, July 17th at 7:30 p.m. to hear a live broadcast of Bill McKibben speaking at Clark College in Vancouver.
This is Ren Green. I'm here with Peter Clark, the general manager of What the Festival, and we're here to talk about his upcoming event. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you so much, Ren. It's wonderful to be here.
So tell us, what is What the Festival?
So What the Festival is a music and arts experience-oriented festival. We create a very immersive environment for our attendees to experience. We build many different micro-experiences and feature four stages of music that range from small gypsy LOL stage up to our big main stage performing artists.
And when and where is What the Festival this year?
What the Festival is July 26th, 27th, and 28th, and 29th this year, 2013. And it's located just outside the town of Duffer in eastern Oregon.
How far a drive is that from here?
It's about 2 hours from Portland.
That is close. That is very close for what you're getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got some big names in your lineup, and I noticed Opulent Temple is participating. They are a Burning Man thing. To what extent are you like Burning Man?
Opulent Temple is kind of an interesting test for us this year to kind of experiment with a stage that's curated and hosted by an outside group. We are very Burning Man influenced. A lot of our core organizers are many, many year burners. And I would say that the similarities are that we really create a safe container for our participants to explore and experiment with their own lives and mind-blowing art and really just come to a place where they can connect with their friends, connect with the environment, and be happy.
What makes What the Festival unique among festivals?
What the Festival is quite unique in that some of the structures that we build are very different. For example, we have a full-scale large waiting pool for attendees, a waiting pool stage. It's two large waiting pools side by side surrounded by a really beautiful cedar deck, and folks can really experience a different type of stage participation when you're standing in the water.
And this is your second year?
That's correct. Last year was our inaugural year. We were in Ty Valley, Oregon, very close to our current location. And we just had a very successful year in 2012. Anytime you create a festival, you have to experience some growing pains. And we feel as though we jumped probably 1 or 2 years ahead of a first-year festival just based on kind of how last year felt.
What inspired What the Festival, and how long did it take you to get the festival up and running from seed idea to reality?
It took us about 9 months. And I would describe it as a very serendipitous coming together of energies that allowed the festival to really coalesce. It's a pretty quick turnaround to decide how we're going to do a festival to 9 months later having it. But, you know, all the right pieces of the equation were there.
And what were those?
Well, you've got a location. You've got a strong base of folks that work in the music industry so that can procure things like talent and, you know, sound and lighting and staging vendors. And then you've got, obviously, folks that are interested in contributing resources to make all the projects come together. And all those things together allowed us to really run with it, put tickets on sale, and create a beautiful event.
What the Festival runs on volunteer participation and audience participation. What do volunteers and audience bring to your event?
We love our volunteers. Volunteers are really the blood, sweat, and tears in a lot of ways of our festival. The volunteers can be found in any department doing just about any job, and we really rely on that giving energy, and it allows us to both take care of them, and some of our volunteers come in and start working on Monday of the event, and they're finished by Wednesday, and they get to just hang out and have a great time and experience the magic. Other volunteers come in, you know, work a very short period of time and then decide to volunteer the entire time above and beyond what they were agreed to for their ticket. But essentially, our labor force is our volunteers, and we just love them so much.
What do alternative music and culture and art festivals do for people? What is the value in people's lives?
I describe it as I've said this before, but it creates a safe container for folks to experiment and explore themselves and learn about our greater culture in an environment like Burning Man, where we're all self-reliant. It really allows that participation to work with people when they can share their neighbors or, you know, they camp next to somebody, and then by the end of the weekend, that person becomes their friend. I feel like it's a place that people really come together and learn more about themselves and about each other than they would typically in a city environment.
Personally, I find it interesting that radical self-reliance leads to really strong community building.
Correct.
How does that happen?
Well, I think when people are reliant on each other, they really get to see each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they get to explore and, you know, rely on those strengths and weaknesses. So if someone's very strong at, say, building, that's going to shine. And I think it allows them to sort of be a candidate that other folks can rely on. And I think that's gives us the ability to exchange the things that we're good at with each other and really come away with a more wholesome perspective on ourselves.
Let's talk about the ways that people can cross-pollinate and exchange and be reliant on one another at what's a festival. What have you got going on exactly?
Well, we've got a lot of different stuff going on. Primarily on our stages is music programming. We have some great headliners this year. We've got A-Track, Purity Ring, Flostradamus, RJD2, Grammatic, Panty Raid, and some other great artists. I'm very excited about Tycho and other artists in our lineup. Please feel free to visit www.whatthefestival.com for a full lineup and any other ticketing information. We also feature a workshop area called the Wamphitheater, which does all kinds of different educational programming, yoga in the morning, and then also at nighttime doubles as our film festival, where we play different curated films and classic films and that kind of thing for folks. We really love to feature micro experiences, areas that are not the big stage. You know, typically many other festivals and events feature kind of a large concert environment, and that's really not what we're about. Although we have that component, we really enjoy it when our people and our attendees can be out in the forest and just get pulled into a small little micro environment and really experience something different with their friends, and that's what where the real magic happens for us. Probably, I think this year we have 6 or 7 large-scale art installations and things where we come out and, you know, there's whole teams of artists building large structures. One of our large art installations this year is Mirror, Mirror on the Ball, built by Glenn Boyd, and it's a 25-foot disco ball. I think something like 1,800, or I can't remember if it's 1,800 or 2,200 mirrors all around the sides of the disco ball. The disco ball itself is about 12 feet wide, and it spins at night, and it's just going to look amazing for everybody. And so we really try to put our emphasis into those kinds of experiences for people to really come away with something different.
What other big art installations do you have planned and that seem exciting?
We've got some works by an artist named Michael Christian. Michael Christian is a metal worker from the Bay Area that's made sculptures from Burning Man to just about every other event on the West Coast. He's bringing up an installation known as Sfei. We have several video mapped installations. A new kind of artistic, creative area right now is video mapping, projection mapping, where people shine light through a projector at a sculpture and essentially work with the shapes of the sculpture to really bring out a 3D kind of environment. So we've got one built by Joey Palikas, which is known as Sunny, which is, I think, 13 triangular petals of a flower, and it's actually interactive by the crowd. They have little buttons and knobs and faders and things they can play with to control the light. And those are a couple of them. We have our LOL stage is brought up by a man named Tyson, LOL. A lot of our names at What the Festival are acronyms, as you can imagine, WTF. So our LOL stage was built by a man named Tyson Anders, and it's known as the Sound Cave. I think it's 9 or 10 different pianos that have been built into this box truck kind of thing, and you go in there and really it's just an audio experience that you can't describe. We try to stay diverse. All of our art is very unique and different, and hopefully that gave you a little sense of what you're in store for.
Interactivity is a strong value.
Very much so, yeah. What the festival features all Function One sound this year. Function One is an audio brand, one of the best in the world, and we will be one of the first festivals in North America to feature all of our stages done with Function One sound. So our Opulent Temple stage, again, like I said before, Opulent Temple is a Burning Man camp, and they're going to be coming up and curating a video-mapped stage, so we're all pretty excited about that.
Are you experiencing any growing pains this year?
You know, I think that we kind of skipped a couple steps in our growth. I mean, I would consider us to be at about the 5 or 6 year festival range. And I think we've got an amazing team together to handle the growth. We're really ready to be a bigger festival. And that being said, we have just been doing everything we can to stay current and work with our partners around the West Coast to really make sure that we're cultivating and curating an event that's of the quality that we would attend, you know, as festival goers.
Who are some of your partners?
Well, there's many events that we sort of collaborate with. One is Lightning in a Bottle, which takes place in Los Angeles. Very similar kind of vibe, I would say. Another event would be the Symbiosis Gathering. Folks that are down in the Bay Area are good friends and allies of ours. Burning Man would be one of our biggest inspirations. I think most of our staff are veteran burners and folks that have been out on the playa for many, many years. We really bring that message home, as well as far as internal self-reliance and radical self-reliance, carrying the Burning Man principles into our event as well.
But in a more pleasant environment.
Correct. A little less harsh. Our property is amazing. It's this year for 2013 event. What the festival is located the closest, in one of the closest locations to the Mount Hood National Forest on the eastern slope of Mount Hood. So our views of Mount Hood are shocking. They're humongous. You have Mount Hood and you have Mount Adams, both viewable from the festival site. The site is known as Wolf Run Ranch. It's a 245-acre ranch in eastern Oregon. We're very proud to call it home.
What are you hoping to add to later festivals?
You know, as we grow, we really learn a lot about what we're capable of and what our staff is capable of and what the participants want to see. And I think that we'll continue to evolve with our participants. It's our goal to be a real destination festival. I think last year we noticed that participants were flying in from all over the world for the event. It's not just a locally attended event, and we want to continue that trend and have people coming in from all over the place. We tend to trend in general a bit of a more mature, what I would consider more of a mature audience. It's not young kids. I think 8% of our attendees are under 21, so it's a much older, kind of more mature festival, I would say.
We've mentioned Burning Man a few times. Who is your festival for? If someone out there is listening and thinking, Burning Man, I don't know about that, what would make What the Festival a better experience for them?
Well, I think at Burning Man, you are so on your own and subjected to the elements that you don't really get to experience some of the luxuries of a camping festival in Oregon. I mean, the lush green water alone does a lot. But in general, you know, we kind of bring the Burning Man art experience paired with a big stage and concert experience to kind of give you, you know, both of those worlds. At Burning Man, you can stumble around in the dust and find an amazing stage and watch an act that you love, but it's not there for you and not really put together in a way that's pleasing to the attendee.
And you may also never see that camp again for the rest
right.
of the week.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll wander off or you may not even know where you were.
Yeah, exactly. Very disorienting.
So you're very well situated in the Oregon forest.
That's exactly right. What the Festival really appreciates, KBOO, and putting this interview together. All said and done, we are so excited to have our festival again. We work all year on it, so we'd love it if folks came out and experienced the magic that we're creating. Again, our website is www.whatthefestival.com. Please check in there for ticket information. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Come and participate with us.
I'm Ren Green. I've been speaking with Peter Clark, general manager of What the Festival, which is coming up real soon, July 26th to 28th at Wolf Run Ranch here in Oregon.
And finally today, we hear an interview excerpted from the series Radio EcoShock. Host Alex Smith speaks with Allison Martin from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy about Tennessee fainting goat and the need to keep up the biodiversity of our food chain.
When the Irish potato famine struck in the 1800s, millions died. That is partly because the population depended on a single breed of potato, which caught a disease. It turns out we are putting ourselves in the same situation with farm animals. A single breed of milk cow, for example, is dominating the supply, and those Holsteins are not reproducing well. I caught up with Allison Martin at the Mother Earth News Fair in Puyallup, Washington, on June 1st, 2012. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're in our mobile studio at the Mother Earth News Fair. We've had some great guests so far, and our next one is Allison Martin. She's from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. We're going to talk a bit about goats, but also some other creatures that might interest you. Allison Martin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks so much for having me today.
Well, the goat thing. Now, I had a neighbor who owned goats. He would go away. I would have to look after the goats. I got to know them a little bit. They came around to my house and visited. They weren't very well fenced either. I found them very intelligent creatures. So what are you going to tell our visitors here at the Mother Earth News Fair when you talk about conserving goat breeds?
Yeah, you've described some of the advantages of goats very nicely there. And when I talk with the Mother Earth News Fair listeners, a lot of them are looking at perhaps homesteading with goats. Some of them are interested in just having a few goats in their backyards. And we'll talk about why breeds are important, about the importance of conserving our rare breeds. And we'll talk about the breeds that American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, ALBC, the ones that we work with. And we'll talk a little bit about the basics of husbandry, and then wrap it up with those who are looking for more of a homestead kind of an application about marketing goat products and other ways to put goats to use around the farm.
Well, goats are amazingly productive on very cheap feed, if any feed at all. They will eat so many different things. We were overwhelmed with the amount of yogurt that we could make, the amount of cheese and goat milk. Not everybody likes goat milk. I do. So tell us about the productivity of these animals for people.
The rare breeds, part of the reason that they're rare is because they weren't the most productive of the productive, but what they are is they're great at self-sufficiency. And so these are the ones that are excellent foragers. They're good mothers. They don't really need any help in that category. And they're productive enough for your average small farm, even though they wouldn't be productive enough for a big farm.
Can you tell us about one breed in particular?
One that I love to tell the story of is the Miatonic goat, or also called the Tennessee fainting goat. And this one always makes people smile. You just smiled, because what we know them for, there's awful videos out there on YouTube of people chasing after them with umbrellas and they fall over, because they have a reflex when they're scared that their muscles stiffen up. That's what myotonic means. But there's some really good advantages to having that particular reflex. One is, goats are known for not staying inside fences. Well, these goats, because when they get scared, they stiffen up. They actually don't climb fences or try to challenge the fences very much. It's just a lot harder for them to do that, because if they get startled halfway through, they're going to have trouble getting through the fence. But also, for people that are raising goats for meat, and I know some of your listeners might be interested in that, this is like isometric exercises for these goats all day long. They're tightening those muscles and loosening them hundreds of times a day, not necessarily falling over, but just getting stiff. And that's like doing exercise, and it makes these guys little meaty, buff animals. They're really, really fit. So really good-tempered and a great all-around homestead animal.
Now, what about if I want to have a goat for the backyard or a couple of goats in the backyard? What would you recommend there that would help keep these goat breeds going?
Well, you know, one to consider would be the San Clemente goat, particularly for those of your listeners that live in California or in the West, because this was a breed that was on an island off the coast of California. It was a lighthouse island, and they were originally taken out there for the lighthouse keepers. But the lighthouse keepers, they had night jobs, so the goats were pretty much left to themselves to fend for themselves and became very independent. After the lighthouse was closed, the goats stayed out on the island until they were eventually removed. And the San Clemente Island goats, they're a small goat. If they're raised from birth with people around, they can be very friendly and good with children. And they're one of the rarest of the rare, and so a great goat to consider for the backyard.
So how does the Conservancy find these rare breeds of goats, and how do we keep them going?
it's all about networking. And so we work with where there are breed associations. We work with the breed associations. A lot of times we just have our own network of farmers and breeders. And we try and provide technical support to them. So if you're at all familiar with the Agriculture Extension Service, in a lot of ways we do similar work, but specifically for endangered and heritage breeds. We provide a lot of breeding advice, but we also provide a lot of advice to people that are just starting out in farming and trying to figure out what they want to do and how to do it.
So why is it important that we have biodiversity in farm animals, even as we consider we must have in the wild?
Yeah, so you raise a good question. I mean, it's the same reasons for preserving the biodiversity in our ecology in the world, but it's also about keeping your options open. You know, it's about mitigating risk, as they talk about in the financial world. And so, you know, a good example that we like to use is that of the potatoes that were raised in Ireland. Before the potato famine, it was all one variety of potato. And then a virus came in, and that one variety of potato succumbed to the virus, and people starved to death. And we hope that we won't have anything like that happen, but it is a risk that so much of our agriculture today is based on very, very few breeds. So to carry that into the animal world, you've got everybody dependent on the Holstein cow for milk. And the Holstein cow has gotten, even though there are lots of them out there, they've gotten rather inbred because they've been so selected for milk production that other things have fallen by the wayside. And so those cows, they really usually are only kept for a year or two on the farms because they can't get them pregnant after that, as opposed to like a heritage breed where those are known for easy mothering. They're known for long life and fertility. So it's about keeping our options open and keeping our portfolio diversified.
And you were talking to me just a little bit earlier about a special kind of pig. Would you tell us that story?
Sure. We're real excited about this new project. This is the Choctaw hog, and it is one of the rarest of the rare. We believe that there are somewhere around 100 to 150 animals remaining today. It's an American breed. It's descended from pigs that came to North America with the Spaniards about 400 years ago and was raised in the Southeast. Mostly, they were raised by the Indians there. They'd gotten loose from the Spaniards. And so the Choctaw Indians in the Southeastern United States were raising these pigs. But then when they were forced to move along the Trail of Tears from the Carolinas and Tennessee to Oklahoma, the pigs went with them. And the archaeologists know that the pigs went with them. They found pig bones. And the pigs were raised on the reservations in Oklahoma. And they've dwindled down now. There's very, very few of them left. But because they were on the reservations, ALBC has known about them for many years. We've considered them to be critically endangered, but we really didn't have access until very recently. And my colleague, Jeanette Berenger, was out in Oklahoma checking up on Choctaw horses, which was a rescue for ALBC about 5 years ago, and met a couple of the farmers who are raising these pigs. And so now we've got some folks that are willing to work with us so that we can start to expand that population. We're going to tame down some of these pigs. A lot of them are raised out on open range and test them for health. We're going to do some DNA testing. And mostly we're going to watch them and find out what they're good for. How fast do they grow? What kind of diet do they like? Are they good mothers or bad mothers? Are they fat or lean? There are a lot of things that we really don't know about these pigs, and that can make it very exciting. So that's a project we'll be developing within the coming year.
Have you got other farm animals that you're really watching for and that you're specializing in?
We work with all the farm animal species. So we have cattle, horses, donkeys, goats, sheep, chickens, turkeys, ducks, geese, rabbits. So we work with it all. And some of them are very, very rare. We actually do census work on each of the species and prioritize based on how rare they are. And so the rarest of the rare get more attention from us than those that are, in, for example, recovering, that a lot of people are using them on the farms. It's a lot of variety and a lot of fun.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Allison Martin of the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. And how do people find out more about the Conservancy? Tell us about your website or blog, or what have you got?
We've got a huge amount of information out on our website. That's www.ALBC-USA.org. And we put breed snapshots out there. We have a breeder's directory where people can find people who are already raising these animals, both for networking or if you want to find some animals to buy and raise for yourself. And through the website or through our email, you can contact us, and we're happy to talk with you one-on-one, too, about any questions you have about what you want to raise on your own farm.
Allison Martin, I want to thank you for introducing me to yet another aspect of environmentalism because, you know, I knew about rare breeds of apples, for example. I've tracked them over the years, but I hadn't really thought about the farm animals. You've taught me something new today, and I think you've taught all of our listeners something, so I thank you for that.
Oh, thank you, Alex.
That was Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock, speaking with Allison Martin of the Livestock Breeds Conservancy.
You're tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the news.
For KBOO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy with your news headlines. George Zimmerman was found not guilty of manslaughter over the weekend, touching off mass protests around the country, including protests in downtown Portland yesterday evening. Zimmerman was being tried for the shooting death of an unarmed black youth, Trayvon Martin, in Florida. The local Occupy movement has begun a new protest at Mount Tabor Reservoir. The protest is co-sponsored by Friends of the Reservoirs, the Montevilla Neighborhood Association, Occupy Portland, and Camp Cascadia. Protesters are challenging the city's decision to stop fighting a federal mandate to cover the city's open reservoirs. The action began Friday and is ongoing. Covering the reservoirs will cost the city hundreds of millions of dollars at a time when Portland has struggled to cut $20 million from its budget. Three people have been arrested so far at the protest for pitching signs, for posting signs, pitching a tent, and for attempting to remain on park grounds after midnight. U.S. officials are reportedly blocking significant changes to international treaties regarding taxation of multinational corporations. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, was tasked with proposing new rules to be presented at the upcoming meeting of the G20, scheduled to meet in Moscow this Friday. The OECD had been expected to present new rules that would be specifically targeted at multinational corporations. France has taken the lead in challenging these type of taxation issues following the revelations that multiple individuals connected to the French president's government were connected with secret offshore tax avoidance schemes. In challenging the new rules, U.S. officials have cited